It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Who among us did not have one of those days in middle school when you wish the world would end? For Hap Conklin, that's actually a very real prospect. Conklin is the young, sometimes bearded character at the center of a series of middle grade novels by Milwaukee native Paul Noth.
The latest is called How to Properly Dispose of Planet Earth, and Noth, who is also a New Yorker cartoonist, joins us in the studio to give us a preview. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
Well, and so for people who are just catching up with Hap Conklin, remind us who he is.
Hap is he starts off in the fifth grade in the first book, and he has a very sort of large and crazy family that drive him crazy. In book one, he gets the opportunity to improve his situation by selling one particularly despotic member of his family to a group of aliens. But he doesn't realize that it's sort of a package deal, and it ends up he ends up selling his whole family to the aliens, and he has to get them back.
And here in book two, he has gone on, I believe, to middle school at this point.
Yes,
right?
He's now in sixth grade. Things are going a little bit better for him. He's not as he doesn't feel quite as oppressed and frightened as he did in book one. He's a little more confident. Trouble starts when he meets a girl. Her name is Nev Everly, and he would really like for her to be his lab partner. only he is unable to speak in her presence, and he figures out a way that he could stop time in order to think of something clever and funny to say, and that would allow him to ask her to be his lab partner.
This is, of course, the dream of every sixth grade boy.
Exactly. Exactly. But
I am still trying to think of the right thing to say to the girl that I wanted to make jokes to in sixth grade.
Right, exactly. And he thinks if he just had a little bit more time, he would be able to think of that reply.
There's a great series of cartoons, by the way, along with that concept.
Right. Where the way he has things planned and the way things actually turn out, a side-by-side comparison. Unfortunately, in the process of this, he accidentally opens a black hole when he tries to stop time, and now it's going to swallow his classroom and swallow the school, the Earth, the solar system, probably, unless he can figure out a way to stop the black hole.
And being able to do that involves the use of his faithful and sometimes not faithful lizard, Squeep.
Yes. Squeep the lizard has become a bigger and bigger part of the story. Hap isn't really sure if it's actually his lizard, because Squeep seems to have more of a life than Hap does and has a lot more going on. And so it's not so much his lizard as just a lizard that lives with him whenever it decides to live with him and shows up whenever it decides to show up.
I can't remember whether we covered this ground exactly, but you come from a relatively large family.
Yes.
How much of the very kind of complex relationship between the Conklin siblings and their father and their elders is taken or maybe exaggerated from what it was like with the Noth family experience?
It's I say it's not based on the Noth family, but I think it is based on the way it felt growing up in a family like that. I have two brothers and six sisters. We all lived on the east side in a four-bedroom house. And so there was this sense of, you know, there was a sense of, I had a sense of like, it's unusual. I had a great loyalty and love for my family, and we're all still very close. But I also had a feeling of being, you know, of never having anything be my own, of people constantly being around, of, you know, a desire to get free of all of them all the time. And also a little bit of feeling unusual and like an outcast because of the family situation.
Well, and the Conklins, they're always these kind of shifting alliances. And I imagine when you're in a family like that, you know, you're always taking advantage of whatever alliance you can with whoever you can in whatever the situation dictates.
Yes. I grew up with this idea of like there's sort of a complicated group dynamic or sort of political palace intrigue going on among the siblings and who has power and who doesn't. And I feel like that's without me even trying to, I can't, even when I just draw a picture, I just add a lot of characters naturally. I've noticed that with comic artists that sort of were only children or came from small families, there's a lot of solitude in their panels. And with me, I just, from the time I was a kid drawing pictures, I just filled the page up with people because that was my reality. That was sort of the experience growing up.
Hap Conklin is not Calvin.
No, he's not. He does not have to. He does not have to sort of invent a companion. He has like almost too many companions, is how he feels.
Well, and Hap's sister Alice turns out to wield this kind of immense power in the middle school where they both go to school, and you know, obviously exaggerated from a real life kind of experience, but I am not the youngest in my family, but I always kind of, you know, you talk about younger siblings going to school and having to deal with the specter of their older and more powerful siblings who have already been there.
Yes, that's definitely part of this book. And that does come from my experience. I think that's why I sort of picked up on that idea and it began to resonate with me. Alice in the first book, she sort of, you know, she steals everything that belongs to him. And that was a real feeling. And I think that might be, even if you have just a couple siblings, there might be that sense, that memory of that. But that, I felt that way really strongly growing up, that I couldn't have anything that was mine. There was no particular sibling that Alice was based on. But I did have the feeling, especially of going into middle school and high school, of, you know, I had two older sisters who went before me. And there was a real sense of like, oh, that's their brother. In some ways, I realized that they were more impressive people than I thought they were, because, you know, my older sisters, Jeannie and Felicia, they had this reputation that I could almost sort of ride on their coattails. But there was a disadvantage to that, too, you know.
I'll have you know that not long after the last time we spoke, I had cause to interview Jeannie.
Oh, okay, great.
And I think she was surprised to find out that I was referring to her as the sister of Paul.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for that. I wish everyone in your listening audience could do that to her from now on. I'd really appreciate it.
What are Noth get-togethers like today? I mean, there are clearly a lot of funny people in your family.
Yes, there are. There, you know, and I'm not one of the, and weirdly, I'm not one of them. Well, I have sort of a quiet sense of humor, and I like to draw everything down on a picture, and I wasn't, you know, and people in my family, it tends to be, you know, who is the loudest and who's the quickest, you know, verbally, and so, you know, it's a lot of very, very, you know, smart, funny, clever people. So it's fun. But it's also there are still some of those complex dynamics going on that I mentioned earlier.
But I would imagine you would probably be top of the heap at, what is it, Pictionary, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly. I try and steer things towards Pictionary whenever possible.
So we talked a lot the last time, I think, about your cartooning, but I'm not sure I realized that fiction was initially your aim, right?
Yeah, well, it was in around the late high school and college. That's when I got into books, the kind of books you know with words and not just, you know, words and pictures, books and especially science fiction. And then in college, I sort of gravitated towards that, and I was a writing major, and I wrote some very strange literary fiction before I got around to doing this. But the first thing that sort of worked for me was comedy writing and cartoons. Those are the first things I began to sell. Cartoons to the New Yorker and comedy writing for, you know, various places, and Conan O'Brien and other places since then. And so my initial goal, though, what I kind of fell in love with first was storytelling.
What's the transition back and forth between reaching kind of the older audience that you write for with The New Yorker, presumably, and the somewhat younger audience here been like? I mean, do those two things, do you see them bleed over in any ways?
Sometimes. I feel like they're very different, and the only thing really that's connecting them is my sensibility in my work and what I have to get things to my own. For both audiences, I just do what I think is funny. You know, and try to do, you know, have my own point of view come forward.
But I wonder, you know, thinking about your sister and your somewhat famous brother-in-law, when they put together material, they get kind of instant feedback,
yes,
on whether it is funny and whether it has had its desired effect. What is it like for you to put this stuff out in the world thinking it's funny to you, but not necessarily knowing that you've reached the people you're intending in the way you're intending?
Yeah, it's a slower feedback loop, or I guess a larger feedback loop, because it takes more time for me to find out if people like the ideas as much as I do. And I think what that's, you know, I'm I think that I slowly build confidence in that, no, I like this. And sometimes I put it out there not knowing whether other people will like it, you know, and just like I have to really just trust my judgment as to whether or not they'll like it. And I think on one thing that's happened since the first book is I've been touring a lot more. I get questions from audiences of kids all the time.
Well, I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
What do you hear from them?
Well, I mean, the question I got every time was, where do you get your ideas? How do you become a writer? You know, and it was through answering that over and over again that I started to realize how much I rely on my notebooks and my sketchbooks to just capture everything so I remember it and then develop the ideas over time. So I always tell them that I don't actually remember writing the idea for How to Sell Your Family to the Aliens. It was just one of my ideas in all these notebook ideas that I found one day. And I show them the page. I do a PowerPoint presentation for them, and I show them the particular page, and I show them all of the books that I carry around, and I recommend to them, especially the ones that are interested in doing creative things, that they carry around a book, just a bad idea book, I call it. I write bad idea on the front of a notebook, and I said, because it's just for you, and you don't have to, it frees you up, it allows you to be creative, and you can, you know, you can decide later whether who you want to share it with or whether you like it tomorrow. I think that's what's helped a lot. Like, in a way, the feedback I get is from myself tomorrow. You know, do I still like this? Is this still funny? And if it stays funny for me for a couple of days, or if it resonates with me the way that, you know, these stories do, you know, then I know that I'm onto something. Like this one, the second one, I feel like when I had the idea of talking to the girl being like something that could open a black hole and swallowing the universe. After that, the book came very quickly because I'm like, yeah, no, that's it. That's what it felt like, you know, when I was that age, you know.
Right. And there are times when you're that age and you actually do talk to a girl that you wish that a black hole
right.
would open up and swallow the universe.
Right. Exactly. I like that. I like taking
I remember being 23 and that happening.
Yeah. Just taking the feeling of it, taking the worst case scenario and just letting it happen, you know, is sort of the idea.
Nine siblings growing up. There's a lot of pressure to, I imagine, with that many people around in a four-bedroom space, get rid of a lot of things. And
yes.
The question is, do any of your earliest journals and notebooks still exist, or did they all go right after they were finished?
Unfortunately, none of them exist anymore. Now and then I'll hear from, you know, and I think that's just bound to happen with that many kids. Despite my parents' best efforts to preserve things.
No refrigerator large enough in the world.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. There's no refrigerator large enough, and you just have to assume that there's just going to be a certain amount of, like, you know, wear and tear on everything. We're not going to have, you know, a TV or a stereo that lasts very long. You know, it'll just be broken eventually. It's little kids running around, that type of thing. So
you can, but in the end, you know, 30 years, 35 years down the road, there's not evidence of Paul Noth's earliest drawings.
Not that I know of, unless any of my teachers are listening. Maybe some of them still have. That's my only hope.
Have you looked on eBay?
Yeah, right.
Well, give us a quick flash forward. What is the third book that we can look forward to?
The third book continues the sort of the science fair story, but one of the major problems that Hap faces is that people think he's dead. And in fact, some of them think he's a ghost when he tries to communicate with them. And so it's called How to Win the Science Fair When You're Dead. And he's in a difficult situation, but it also ties together both of the stories, the story that we deal with in the first book concerning his grandma and the aliens, and what we bring up in the second book concerning, you know, this girl and the black hole and all of that, and Squeak the Lizard.
Well, Paul Noth, I hope you'll come back and see us again then, but congratulations on book number two.
Oh, thanks so much. It was great to be here.
Milwaukee native Paul Noth's latest middle grade novel is called How to Properly Dispose of Planet Earth. It is the second in a trilogy. The writer and cartoonist will talk about his writing Saturday at 2 at Boswell Book Company. You can see some of his drawings from the book and from The New Yorker at wuwm.com.